Today we have Jacob Rogers with us. He's a translator from Galician and Spanish. He has won grants from National Endowment for the Arts and the Penheim Translation Fund and co-edited Features of Galician Literature for Words Without Borders, Asymptote and The Riveter. He has translated Manuel Rivas' The Last Days of Terranova for Archipelago Books and Berta Davila's The Dear Ones for Three Times Rebel. He spoke about his experience of being a bookseller and translator, author Manuel Rivas, translations from Galician language and about indie publisher Archipelago Books. So welcome to our podcast, Arshanim, Jacob.
Thanks for having me.
So when and how did you come across Galician literature?
So I studied Spanish sort of later in college. I was lucky enough to go to public schools where we studied Spanish since I was like seven. But in college, I ended up continuing on accident with my Spanish. And I happened to take a course that was specifically focused on the sort of regional complexities of Spain. And I asked my professor to just assign me the best possible group of students, where we had a project where each group would do a different region. So I just happened to be assigned Galicia, and I happened to be interested in literature already. So I decided that would be my focus, is what could I find about the literary culture in Galicia. And from there, there's a website called the Portico of Galician Literature, where a Galician translator named Jonathan Dunn has sort of been cataloging Galician writers and been collecting these long samples in English as well as biographical information. So even before I was able to read Galician, I had this sort of like wealth of stuff in front of me that I could see that there was a lot there. But yeah, I just first came across it totally by accident almost. yeah, it was just through that one college class.
Which is the first book that you read in Galician literature and really liked it?
That is a difficult question because I have a bad memory, and this is probably about 10 years ago. But I think maybe I'll just say a couple. There's one of my beloved authors who I still work with today, Xurxo Borazas. He wrote this sort of cult classic, insane book called EOE, which means I is, that's kind of like a road novel where the narrator is driving down through Portugal and like picks up a hitchhiker, and then they just sort of start having sex on the beach all the time. But there's just this recurring joke throughout where they're in Portugal, but they're speaking Galician, which is a true thing that people in Galicia always say. You can go to Portugal and just speak Galician and people understand you. And so, but he's just a really fascinating writer who's like, he's very, I don't want to say transgressive, because he's not trying to be offensive, but he likes to push boundaries, and he's very playful with language. So that was like a very great first introduction.
So Spanish is more fashionable to translate. There is a huge contingent of translators. Why Galician for you?
So I guess going back to that class that I took when I sort of first discovered what it was and all these authors, it was around that time that I was becoming interested in translating in and of itself. And I had sort of started to, you know, there's these famous Argentinian writers like Cortázar, who I was like, oh, I'll just translate them just for fun. Like, I know that they've already been published. But I think even back then, I just kind of had a sense that Spanish is, there's just a lot of, it's like you said, it's fashion. There's a lot more people doing it. And so it just felt like a bit of a crowded environment. And it just seemed like there was so much in Galician, and not that there's no one doing it, but just that there's so much still had yet to be done. And that might be sort of an interesting place for me to see if I could find a sort of make my way and like carve out a little place for myself. So somewhat cynical, to be honest, but it didn't take long for me to just find the enjoyment out of it in and of itself.
So Jonathan Dunn, I read about him, and of course you are there. So how many translators are there from Galician to English right now? Active translators who are doing it? regularly?
I mean, we could probably say about 10. I'm probably missing some people because, I think it's easy to forget that if people aren't publishing all the time, that doesn't mean that they aren't active per se. But yeah, so in terms of pros, there's very few of us. Me, Jonathan Dunn, who's the main, sort of been the main translator of Galician for a long time. Kathleen March, who's a professor in Vermont. There's another translator, Neil Anderson, who hasn't been as active lately, I don't think. And then poetry, there's actually, I mean, Galician, I know you guys focus mostly on prose in the podcast, but Galician poetry has like a very centuries old tradition and a lot of great writers. And so a lot of the translators who work in Galician actually just focus mostly on poetry. Like Erin Mowday is kind of like a god of translation, I think, even for a lot of people in the States, and part of a lot of what she's done has been with Galician.
There are about 350,000 people who understand Galician, right? All over the world.
My understanding is the speaker figure they say is about 2 million. It's difficult because it's such an emigrant region too, so you have a lot of people who aren't living there who may speak it, but I don't know if they'd be counted.
No, I'm sorry. Google says it's 4 million people.
Oh, 4 million. Okay. But yeah, and then the reading public is a very different number and probably much smaller. Not that people can't read it, but just how many people are sort of actively reading Galician literature.
So most of this get translated into Spanish too.
Sadly, not really, to be honest. Not that. So I think you tend to have it happen where there will be a few big authors who are getting a lot of notoriety and being translated into Spanish by major publishing houses. There's been some effort by a couple of the publishing houses to just produce their own Spanish translations, but the obvious problem with that is that they already have a Galician audience. That Galician audience doesn't need their Spanish translation. So I'm not sure that anyone is really reading those Spanish translations. So it's actually not nearly as many Spanish editions of Galician books that I think I or anyone would like, just because it's even within Spain, I think it's still sort of on the periphery of literary culture if you're writing in Galician. So it's only every once in a while that you'll get a breakthrough author who really just sort of not just is translated, but actually starts to sort of garner attention in the whole country.
So you translate from Spanish too, and how similar is Galician to Spanish vocabulary, the way it sounds?
They are very similar, particularly in just in the way that Portuguese and Spanish are very similar, as not just as Romance languages, but they develop side by side. And Galician historically is the same root as Portuguese. So to some extent, the similarities to Spanish have come in a large way just because they've been sort of in a colonial framework with Spain for, I guess, 500 years. So you've just had a lot of sort of infection of Spanish colloquial language and Spanish words, Spanish phrases, Spanish grammar. But a lot of the backbone of the grammar of Galician is still more close to Portuguese. So when I was first learning, I found that because I already knew Spanish, it was generally very easy to read Galician. The way that the orthography is much more similar looking to Spanish than it is to Portuguese. But to be honest, it kind of depends on the writer. Some people will write in a very quote unquote accessible Galician that has a lot of similarity to Spanish, not similarity, but just sort of has a lot of more common Spanish crossover vocabulary. And then some people are, I don't even know if the words they're using are collected in the dictionary. It's not that they're making them up, but it's still the process of normalizing the language, which has its drawbacks, but is still relatively new. So there's a lot of people who are using words that aren't necessarily accepted as standard, even if we would argue that they are words. So there's a lot of richness, but it kind of depends author to author.
What are the typical challenges you face when translating from Galician to English? Like in the case of gender, is it something similar to Portuguese where you have genders with for adjectives and verbs too?
Yes, it's the same. I think I would say exactly the same Portuguese and Spanish. Yeah, they're entirely gendered in there. Every or almost every adjective will have to correlate to the gender of the subject, which, is one of those things where we have the benefit of not having that in English, but at the same time, because they have it in Galicia and they're able to phrase things some ways that you can use two words in Galician that imply a lot more just because you've been able to include the gender, where because the gender isn't specified in English, you kind of end up having to use six words just to translate two. But then one of the other big challenges is kind of what I was saying before about the dictionary and the normalizing is because it's a language where there's a lot of controversy, not controversy, but I have like three different Galician dictionary websites that I use that are just in very different place because the very official normative Galician dictionary misses out on so many things. So I often there's a dictionary that's more in the Portuguese framework as a Galician dictionary that I tend to find has a lot more definitions. But yeah, sometimes it is just genuinely a challenge figuring out what something means. And then the other main thing is that with Spanish, I have such a wealth of forums. Forums are one of the best places to find answers to what things mean. And with Spanish, you just have so much of that with people specifically looking for English translations of Spanish phrases and words. But with Galician, obviously, that's not as much of a, or really, it's not available at all almost. So it requires a lot more investigation.
So, have you visited Galicia?
Yeah, actually, so I first spent they offer subsidized courses in the language every summer. So I did that 2 summers in a row a long time ago when I was in my early 20s. And they do those in the capital, Santiago, which is also the big pilgrimage site for Catholics. So summer is a very crazy time to be there. But so yeah, I had spent a couple months over those summers, but then I also taught English in Spain for a couple of years, and one of those I spent in Vigo, which is the biggest city in Galicia, tied with another, but I think slightly the biggest city. And then like a lot of sort of small, I was actually on a residency there last March for a month, so I try to make it back as often as I can.
So compared to US, I think it must be quite a different experience culturally for you too.
Yeah. But everyone, when I first went to Spain, everyone would find out that I was on my way to Galicia eventually, and they would all say, "Oh, you're going to eat so well," because Galicia is kind of known within Spain for having some of the best food. So it's not a bad place to be.
So you translate a lot of poetry too. So experientially, how do you differentiate between translating poetry and prose?
To be honest, I don't know if I do enough, or maybe it's better that I don't really. I think that I'm such a sort of a I've studied like in college I actually studied literature, but almost entirely was focused on prose and fiction, and so I think that I have a lot more tools at my disposal to sort of analyze a fictional text than I do poetry. So as a reader of poetry, I tend to be a bit obtuse and very like I just know something if I know if I like something or I don't, and I'm not as good at sort of engaging with it on a intellectual or formal level, and I think that I tend to just translate things that speak to me on that voice level, so I just kind of treat them the same as I would a text for the most part. I've definitely avoided things with meter and rhyme that are very structured, or maybe I just haven't noticed, but I think I try to avoid anything that will force me to be counting beats or figuring out a metrical structure, because it's in some ways it seems like fun, but in some ways it's kind of a nightmare. So yeah, I think I try to I think poetry did help me translate prose in a way because it does allow you to realize that I think it confronts you sometimes more directly with the fact that you cannot always keep the structure exactly as is if you want to bring the same effect across. You know, if you need 5 words to translate what was one in the original or two or vice versa, sometimes you want to change the line structure so that you can kind of maintain the. And so kind of having that realization come to me through poetry, I think did actually end up filtering into prose a little bit, where I was like, well, things don't have to be the way that they are. What I'm going for is impact and effect, and I don't need to just stick to the letter of the law. So it was actually very helpful. I mean, I think for me, I think.
Now we will come to the books that you translated. First one is the Dear Ones from Pertha Devilla. Tell us about the book and the author.
I guess I was talking earlier about people who managed to break into Spanish and sort of gain more national awareness. I think she's probably the most, I don't know, I shouldn't say so much because I'm not there, but I feel she's one of the more beloved and sort of critically acclaimed writers in Galicia right now. So The Dear Ones was her fourth novel. She's already released another one. She's very quick. So it wasn't that long ago that was her latest novel, but now it's already changed from her to be her second most recent novel. Yeah, I mean, I just find I've always found her to just be fascinating because I don't tend to gravitate towards the more quiet, sort of minimalist writers, at least in terms of my own translating voice. I tend to be gregarious and not know how to finish a sentence. So I've always enjoyed reading her work because she's able to get so much into so little. And that when I first started trying to translate her, it was the big challenge in the way that I like. And so then when The Dear Ones was sold to this press in the UK, I was obviously very excited. And had to do, I was like, wow, I've totally lost my train of thought. But anyway, so yeah, The Dear Ones basically, so it's a book about, it's very meta in the way that it's sort of starts out being about a writer who has so long avoided writing about pregnancy and motherhood because she's sort of taking herself to account for saying, like, for a long time she thought these were not things that were sort of worthy of literature and didn't need to be written about. And of course, here we are with this book, so she has obviously finally sort of gotten over that feeling and is basically writing about the experience of at one point going through a lot of IVF treatments and having a couple of miscarriages, but still really wanting and trying to have a child. Finally having success, going through postpartum depression, all of that, and just having a really rough time for about a year before finally sort of getting to a more comfortable place mentally and just in terms of life. And then a few years later, accidentally getting pregnant again with her current partner, and then deciding to have an abortion, sort of juxtaposed against that, the intensity of the desire for that first child. But it's an interesting book because she writes it in a way that, you know, the main character is very insistent that she has nothing to feel guilty about for wanting and having the abortion, and she's aware and she doesn't feel guilty, but it remains a very difficult thing for her to do just because it's a sort of privacy that you would rather people not be, it's a privacy that you would rather people not intrude upon and would rather not tell people, but it's sort of hard to avoid in some ways. And she constantly worries if her grandmother finds out, what will her grandmother think? But so yeah, it's a very like subtle and very beautiful book. And so I'm very glad that it's been translated. But yeah, her latest novel is also out now, and I'm working on a co-translation. We're trying to find a publisher. So fingers crossed. She's really one of my favorite authors, so I'd like to bring a lot of her work in, or basically all of her work into English.
So before we move on to the next book, how do you pick books to translate? Any leaning towards any particular themes or style of writing? Or
That's a good question, actually. Yeah. I I think it's somewhat intuitive. I read a lot in Galicia, and I haven't been reading as much lately just because I haven't been there and I already have such a backlog of other things. But I, during the year that I spent there in Galicia, and then every other time that I go, I am probably taking out like 10 books a week from the library, and not necessarily finishing them, but I'm just, it's this like encyclopedic sort of impulse where I just am trying to wrap my head around what's out there and like try to find what I like and stick with that. And so I'll find an author, and then if I like one book, I'll sort of try to track down everything else they do. But so yeah, it's mostly intuitive. I just try to gravitate towards what I like, and then a little bit of a calculation will come in where I'll think, well, is this, I should also say I work as a bookseller in the US, so I like to think I have a good sense of, especially the independent presses here. So I'm always kind of thinking like, is there someone I can think of who might want to publish this? And I haven't been successful in that front, so I shouldn't make it sound like this is some special knowledge that I have and it's served me greatly. But yeah, I'm always first going by like, did I like it? Did it really like interest me and like stimulate me in a way that I think that I would enjoy translating it? And then secondly, do I think there's actually someone who would publish it, or you know, does it, is it going to sort of resonate at all? Which can be hard, because sometimes if something feels like it's so particular and so Galician in its context that people might not understand it, it's like, oh, it's a great book, but I'm not sure if I could convince someone, like, how do I explain this book to someone who doesn't have the sort of the background? Like there was a major book that won a prize a few years ago that was sort of based on this mythology that has come up around what this man who's, or this person who was sort of colloquially referred to, I think, as the world's first serial killer, who was around, I want to say, in the 19th century in Galicia, and killed a lot of women and et cetera. And he's always had this, and he was known as the wolf man. For a long time, I'm not as familiar with this as I should be, but the point being, there was some research that came out based on some bones that were found that maybe this person was actually intersex. And so this writer wanted to write a book about sort of used going off of that, and like, in, if it wasn't actually a man but was an intersex person, and that was all invested. But it's just written in such a way that it doesn't, it's very poetic and it doesn't give you a lot of context, so if you don't know what's going on, and so it's like, it's a beautiful, amazing novel, but I just was like, I don't know if anyone would really get this at all in English, so I'm not sure that it, you know, like, I don't think it would really land, because you just wouldn't know. I barely knew it was happening sometimes, I think, because I don't have enough context. But yeah, I guess that's a long way of explaining that point.
Any interesting interactions with the authors? What, the way you translated?
To be honest, I've been extremely lucky in that sense. I don't know that I've repressed it, but I don't think I've ever really gotten into proper arguments with anyone in general. I've basically only had great experiences with, including even the people I translate in Spanish, but in Galician, I think especially, just because a lot of these people aren't even necessarily being translated into Spanish. And so I think it's just kind of exciting. Even if we just get like a short story published in a magazine, there's something so sort of, like if I were a writer, I think just the act of like having someone approach you and say that their work is valuable to your work is valuable to them, and they would like to bring it to other people. So generally I've found people to be extremely generous with their time, especially because I tend to ask a lot of questions and always send emails with a whole paragraph apologizing for all the questions, which are each like a paragraph long. I've had a few. The first writer I mentioned, Xurxo Bonatas, is actually, he translates from English, and is, I think, better at English than I am. And so I have always, whenever I've translated something by him, I've always sent him the drafts, and he always has amazing comments and like suggests things that I would never even have occurred to me. But I mean, mainly I'm just happy. I've been able to meet a lot of the writers that I work with in person. which is just a lot more fun when you can like go out to dinner or get a drink, and just sort of relate as two people rather than just over email. So yeah, been very fortunate.
Specific question is about being a bookseller and translator.
So I first started working as a bookseller actually right when I got out of college in North Carolina. And it wasn't so, and then I moved to New York a few years ago and have been working again as a bookseller here. But early on, it was actually sort of a great cheat code where I could get in touch with all these independent presses that publish translation as a bookseller, you know, oh, would you guys mind sending these books? And then I would say, by the way, I'm also a translator, in case you'd ever be interested in reading Galician books.
Did it work?
Yes and no. Yes, to the extent that it was a nice way to sort of start the conversation. And in a lot of cases, there are people I still feel comfortable reaching out to. But no, just in the sense that I haven't published a book with any of them yet. Not for lack of trying. But yeah, I mean, so in general, it's just been great as a translator because it gives me this access to a lot of especially small press books between my discount and just being able to get galleys where I try to read a lot of what the independent presses are putting out. And in some cases, the more like mainstream big five. So it's, you know, it's like I said earlier that I always have this like encyclopedic impulse with Galician, but I kind of have the same thing here where it's, I'm just trying to always see who's publishing what and what kind of thing and languages. So in that way, it's really nice, but also, I actually have always genuinely loved working in a bookstore. And just, I like talking to people in a just sort of casual way. It's just nice to be able to, I think, especially when you're doing a job like translation, some days, you know, you just sit at home on your computer silently or maybe with music, but it's just a very solitary task. And so to be able to alternate that with a job where I'm very distinctly sort of social. So yeah, it's just been nice being able to a very solitary task with something that's just outwardly sort of more focused around talking to people and being social. But they go so well together because I'm working on books at home, but I also get to talk about books at work. And you know, it's having coworkers who are also reading all the time. It's just a very nice ecosystem to be in where you just get to sort of, in some cases, speak ill of certain things in an environment that's safe and comfortable to speak ill of things where you might not do so publicly. But also just to really gush about things. And, you know, people come in looking for recommendations and oftentimes, you know, they may be looking for one thing, but you can always try to recommend something that they might not have picked up on their own, like a independent press or a translated book. I wouldn't say that that's like the norm of every recommendation, but you know, you get those little glimpses into sort of opening people's sort of reading journey, I guess, opening that up a little bit and showing them things that they hadn't really encountered before. So yeah, it's definitely a lot of fun. Also, sometimes you know, publishers or other writers or translators will just sort of pop in just because they're trying to go to a bookstore. So it kind of is like a nice way just to occasionally see people.
Spanish government, does it help or encourage translations from Galician to English in any way?
The Spanish government doesn't provide encouragement per se, but right now, because they're governed by, it's called the PSOE, which is the sort of generally understood as the central left socialist party, they aren't necessarily pro-regional language and pro-regional sort of difference, but they've had to form a coalition with a lot of regional, sort of more regional government backgrounds. And so since they've been in power for the past few years, the system of grants, and so especially around getting funding for contracted published books, has been made a lot easier. And again, I actually should know more about this, but my sense is that because it's somewhat of a coalition government, they have been more proactive about offering funding and really encouraging the funding really overstating the emphasis that the funding is available to all languages of Spain that are officially recognized. So even if I'm translating a Galician language book, I know I can apply for Spanish government funding, which is mostly important because Spain is known for having one of the most stupidly complex bureaucracies around even. And you know, it's sort of a trope, but it is true when it's come to translation funding that they're ranked pretty low by most government. Most people who are trying to translate out of Spanish or a Spanish language is just, you're trying to get a few thousand euros and it's just paperwork and paperwork and paperwork, and they want all this information, but they've made it a lot easier in the past few years, which has been great, because the Galician government, which has been sort of the center right party for probably about 15 years now, is definitely slowly strangling the Galician language. And ostensibly they are, you know, they do offer funding for book projects. It's not at a number that really kept up with the pace of inflation and XYZ. But even though the funding is available, it is one of the most, another translator friend of mine who works from Galician, Keith Payne, has referred to it as Kafka-esque, the process of applying for funding from Galicia. So I actually have not, I have two books out from Galician and neither one of them has received funding from the Galician government. Or sorry, three. The first one received funding. It was through Jonathan's publisher. The other two, I just said, look, I think it's much easier to get it from Spain right now. So if you want, if you value your life or your sanity, don't try with the Galician government. But yeah, so hopefully, unfortunately, the Galicia just had its elections and the same party narrowly held onto its majority. So we're in for a few more years of this, but it looks like the sort of much more progressive left is gaining ground. So my fingers are crossed.
Yeah, no, the other one I wanted to talk to you about, the book is The Last Days of Terra Nova. By Manuel Rivas. It's published by Archipelago Publications. The publisher, this name keeps recurring in many of the interviews that we do. Archipelago, can you tell us a bit about them?
So I think they've been around for a little over 20 years. And were found, I want to say founded by Jill Schulman, who's still the publisher now. I mean, I guess I can't speak too much to their specific ethos, but they've definitely just become known as one of those publishers that have, not only have they just published a lot of great literature, they do try to reach pretty far and wide in terms of the languages they publish. So I remember years and years ago, it was very meaningful for me because I was just getting into translation. They had this really giant Bulgarian novel translated by Angela Rodel. And just, you know, I remember reading it. I was like 20 years old and I was like, oh my God, like this is so good. I can't believe this exists. And so I think, yeah, they've just sort of become known for having a sort of the courage to also just like go out there for books that might have a hard time finding a more sort of mainstream publisher, but also books that are very long and can be a little bit too expensive for others to translate. And Jill is just one of those people who has like a really good, she's just very perspicacious, I think, about the kinds of things she picks up. She just kind of knows, you know, she has her taste, but she's someone that's definitely worth keeping an eye on in terms of like, she has her finger on the pulse. She just, yeah, you know, she has had her, she's liked and followed Manuel Rivas's work for a long time and just never been able to publish him before. But, you know, so she's been sort of aware of this Galician author for years. She just, yeah, I don't know. It's very, and then the rest of the team is also very great. But I guess the other thing is that they're a nonprofit, I think. So that allows them to get, you know, allows them to apply for a lot of grants and receive donations in a way, in a more direct way. And I think that's one of the big, it helps them to sort of keep things afloat and not have to always focus on book sales strictly. This is, we're talking about translated books. They don't always sell very well. So it's part of what I think allows them to have that sort of broad, more intrepid approach.
Now, tell us about Manuel Rivas. I think he's a very prolific writer in Galicia.
Yes. I mean, he's written so much poetry, so many works of prose. He's definitely the most widely translated into English as well. So what I was just mentioning, I think 5 or 6 of his novels have been translated into English by Jonathan Dunne for an imprint of Penguin over the years. And it was, so this Archipelago book was the first of his novels to be translated outside of that framework. But I know Jonathan has published a couple, I think one of his short story collections, and then there's an Irish translator, Lorna Shaughnessy, who's worked on some of his poetry. So he's definitely already the most prolific in English, but within Galicia, he's like a legend. He is definitively famous, I think, as a writer in Spain as a whole, but in Galicia, he's one of those authors that I always joke, people like to gossip over there, as they do anywhere, but I have only ever heard the nicest things about him as a person from every single person I've ever met and talked to about him. So aside from the fact that he's just had the status as a, you know, one of their best writers, I think that part of it is just that everyone who ever meets him is just like taken by his, he's very humble and very kind. But so, yeah, I mean, he wrote, I think the book that kind of made him, the book that brought him the most notoriety, I think in general, is called The Carpenter's Pencil. So he's, you know, he's written a lot of historical fiction that deals with the Civil War and the pre-Civil War, particularly in Galicia. And he just has this very, he's one of those writers who, you know, he really just has sort of taken the language and made it his own. And he just, it feels completely embodied in his work. So he's extremely fun to translate because you can just feel the richness and the elusiveness. He's an amazing reader. I think he's read, I don't even, I mean, I can't imagine how many books. But so he has, yeah, he has this very beautiful, almost lyrical style. And I think that's part of what has helped make him so popular. But also he just has a very deep, I think, humanism, like all of his books. Even if they're about very dark things, I think they're essentially optimistic at their core, and they're very interested in humans being not necessarily good people, but just sort of like they're interested in exploring people with a sense of optimism, even when we're talking about people who do horrible things, like who are the people working against them and like what can we explore with that? Of course, like many films have been made, he's had some big films be made out of his short stories. We even watched one when I was in college, unrelated to being a Galician writer. It was just, you know, he's just that big that, you know, you might watch one of his movies when you're studying Spanish.
The Last Days of Terranova, I just started reading, in fact, a couple of days ago. It was 30, 40 pages, 25, 30 pages. I found it a bit abstract. So what is it about? Can you please?
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. It's very meandering. The basic premise is that it's about an older man who runs a bookstore in the city of A Coruña, which is basically the second biggest city or co-biggest city in Galicia and sort of the cosmopolitan heart of the region. So he runs this bookstore, but he's just had to put up a sign that he's closing the bookstore imminently because his landlord is basically just going to tear down the building and build something new. He's a real estate speculator. So it starts off with him sort of walking around on his cane. He used to have polio, and he's just sort of wandering around the city, ruminating, being mad at himself for putting up the sign that he's closing the store. And he goes out to one of the overlooks of the sea, because it's on the city's on the coast, and it has a very sort of dramatic, dangerous coastline with a lot of rock. And he sees this couple that he's seen out there a lot, and they're gathering shellfish along the rocks, even though there's a massive storm on the way. So when he sees them in danger, he calls the police. And then obviously because he's not trying to get them in trouble. He just thinks that they're maybe about to die. So he calls the police and tries to get a rescue helicopter out there. Obviously they're not trying to get caught, so they run away. But basically, it ends up being that the young woman of the couple is pregnant, and they actually are kind of on the run from some people in Portugal. Anyway, so they end up breaking into the bookstore and needing to take refuge there, which sends him on this sort of Odyssey of Memory, where most of the book actually takes place with him sort of meandering through various parts of his life. Because it basically sends him back to a time when he had known this Argentinian woman who had been in the very militant left during the dictatorship years in Argentina, and she had to flee Argentina basically on fear that they were going to kill her. And he meets her in Madrid, but then takes her back to Galicia, where his parents own this bookstore, and they, you know, they're basically hiding her there because they know there are agents in Spain looking for her as well. So the sort of correlation of giving refuge to this sort of vulnerable young woman in the one time, and then the other sends them on this memory, you know. And he was into like the punk and the metal band scene back in the 70s. So it just kind of goes all over the place. It's like it's kind of a noir novel. There's like a drug and like whatever aspect, but it's also a sentimental thing. It's also a historical novel. So it's doing a lot.
So any particular passage where you found it difficult to translate, difficulty in translation, where you had to spend a lot of time?
One of the overall challenges is just that he references so many books and uses so many different languages, but in particular books that haven't always been translated into English. So I just found myself faced often with questions of, he's just using Italian, but like, can I just use Italian, or like, you know, things like that. I don't think there's any specific passage, but he just has, in some cases, like a sense of humor that can be, you know, it's one of those things where the joke is the joke, and I don't think his sense of humor doesn't come across in English, but sometimes you just really have to work to, you really have to change a sentence to really like give it a sort of pop in English. And so those were probably the most challenging parts, because it's really throughout the whole book, whether it's a certain character who just tends to be funny or just the narrative voice. But those are also, I really enjoy funny books. So those were also the parts that I think I was having the most fun with, and the parts that as I read, whenever I read it back, I always sort of a little maybe too pleased with myself when I read it back and just think, haha, I did it.
Can you read a couple of paragraphs from the book, both in Galician and in English?
So I'm going to read just a short bit from the first chapter. Basically, it's right after the narrator Vicenzo has called the police, but now the police have come to talk to him because they, you know, they brought out a helicopter and nothing happened. So it's just this short little bit of dialogue that I think is fun. The sea was getting ready to claim them, but in the end it was the earth that swallowed them up. The first policeman to get out of his car could tell I was agitated and tried to calm me down. Don't worry about them. They're like jellyfish. Transparent. But any day now they're going to be in for a nasty surprise, and not in the water, on land. They don't have papers, and there's some hot-headed guys with license who would love to knock the teeth out of their smiles. The sergeant came up and greeted me, and not rudely, either. Ah, so you're Mr. Fontana, the Terranova bookman. He, at least, hadn't read the total liquidation sign. He wouldn't stop looking at me, a glimmer of curiosity in his eyes. The disappearance of the Monelos River, I'll never forget that essay. It was a formal complaint. I know, I still have a copy. I have a copy of all the complaints you've filed. The disappearance of Parrote Beach, the expulsion of starlings from the city sky, the eviction of fishermen's boats from the marina as a way to make room for aluminum yachts, the neglect of Art Nouveau buildings, the decrepit state of the old prison. You're right, Mr. Fontana, that prison could be a cultural space. Yes, sir, they're like historical artifacts. Your complaints, I mean, an alternative history to this city. To think how much I've learned from them. It brings a smile to my face every time you file a complaint. I'm glad you've enjoyed reading them, Sergeant, but you should do your due diligence. Of course, the cases are open, he said, gesturing at some point on high. Speaking of due diligence, said the corporal, you're going to have to pay for this. He appeared to be the most veteran among them, his hair white and his tone commanding, not just towards me, but to everyone in the vicinity, including his superior. Pay for what? I asked. What do you mean, what? This rescue operation. Do you know how expensive it is to get a helicopter off the ground? Sure, but it was an emergency. They were drowning. two people, and one of them was pregnant. You can write that novel for the government delegation when they send you the bill. They were in danger, I insisted, looking at the sergeant. I know, Mr. Fontana, you did your citizenly duty, but it's just one of those cases where the regulations have two faces, one human and the other not so much. Well, I called the human side. Don't beat yourself up about it, said the sergeant. The corporal took down the license plate number on the old motorcycle left by the clandestine couple. It was an old model, mud-caked and run down. He gazed out at the rocks once he'd finished. The sea was looking choppier. The inundation was on its way. Now that the sergeant is gone, he said, I have to admit, I like your complaints too. And I'm sorry about the starling. I didn't sign up to be a human cannon and scare them all up with gunfire. But I do have to disagree with you about the disappeared river. It was just a stream, a shitty little stream. Corot, Corot, I said nervously. Corot painted streams like that, and they're works of art. He clicked his tongue and said, you must not have had anything better to paint. Read the Galician now. Estivo a piques de levalos o mar e agora tragaraos a terra. O primeiro guarda que baixou do coche policial viu-me inquieto e intentou tranquilizar-me. Não se preocupe por eles. São como medusas, transparentes. Pero calquera dia levam um disgusto, não do mar, senão da terra. Não tenham papéis, e o seu carné, como lhes coza o xenio, vão-lhes dar uma malheira. Achegou-se o sargento, saudou-me, e não com má cara. Así que vosté de Fontana, o libreiro de Terra Nova. Por lo menos él non lera o letreiro de liquidación final. Non deixaba de mirarme, con curiosidade. A desaparición do río Monelos. Ese foi un texto antolóxico. Foi unha denuncia, dixe. Sí, conservo unha copia. Conservo copia de todas as súas denuncias. A desaparición da praia do Parrote, a expulsión dos estorniños do ceo da cidade, o desaloxo dos barcos marinheiros da Dársena para meter os yates de aluminio, o abandono das casas de Arnouveau, o estado ruinoso da antiga prisión modelo. Ten razón vostede, podía ser un grande obradoiro de cultura. Sí, señor, son pezas históricas, a mellor memoria da cidade, o que se aprende nelas. Dame unha alegría cada vez que presenta unha denuncia. Agradezo moito o seu interese estilístico, sargento, pero algunha vez deberían abrir diligencias. Falando de diligencias, interveo o cabo, vai ter que pagar os gastos. Semellaba o máis veterano, de pelo esbrancuxado, e cun ton de mando que non só me apuntaba a min, senón a todo o orbe, mesmo o seu superior. Que gastos? Preguntei. Que gastos? Os gastos que se derivan da operación. Vosted sabe o que custa mover un helicóptero? Sí, pero foi unha chamada humanitaria. Estaban afogando. Dúas persoas. Unha delas unha mociña preñada. Pois vai escribindo esa novela para cando lle vai a nosa delegación do goberno coa factura. Eran dúas persoas en perigo, insistín mirando o sarxento. Por suposto, Fontana. Vostede cumpriu co deber cidadán, mas danse eses paradoxos en que os regulamentos legais adoitan ter dúas caras, unha humana e outra menos humana. Pois eu chamei a cara humana. Non se culpa, vivite, dixo o sarxento. O cabo anotaba a matrícula da moto abandonada polos dous fuxitivos, unha máquina bella, enlamada e abatida. O rematar mirou caras rochas. O mar ia a máis. Achegábase o temporal. Agora que non está o sarxento, dixo, debo recoñecer que a min tamén me gustan moito as súas denuncias. E sinto o dos estorniños. Eu non quixen facer de home canón para escorrentalos a estoupidos. Ainda que discrepo no asunto do río desaparecido, era un regato, unha merda de río. Corot, Corot, dixe nervioso. Corot pintou regatos así, son obras de arte. Chascou a lingua e dixo, pois non tería outra cousa que pintar.
Thank you for such an enjoyable, wonderful conversation, and thank you for your time.
Yeah, I mean, thank you. I really appreciate you making the time. It was a lot of fun.